Finn's back, but he's quiet. Jess asks if he wants something to eat, but he just shakes his head, no. She assumes nothing new has happened. But she's going crazy locked up in here. Griffin, she starts quietly. She sits down next to him at the table, where he's staring mutely at his laptop. Did you speak to your sister about my case? He nods.
Yes, but it's not good news. They still want to arrest you.
Jess feels her morale sink. But you didn't tell her where I was.
No.
Jess wants to ask why not, but she doesn't dare. She doesn't want to question what Griffin is doing, make him doubt himself. He's a cop, after all. He's still squinting at the screen, and she remembers her thought from the day before. Does he know? Is it on there? She says. He looks up sharply, and with that one expression, he answers the question. He knows. What does it say? She makes herself ask.
Not much.
It's not what they made out, Jess replies, the words falling away before she can stop them. She can't look at him and stares at the piles of newspapers still littering the table. It was an accident. She feels his eyes on her. She needs to tell him now, before she changes her mind. He tried to stop me with the... You know... She gestures towards the bathroom and Griffin nods. It was one of those old-style cutthroat razors that I'd bought for that purpose. It was night. Alice was asleep in bed. I didn't think I'd be disturbed. But Patrick tried to take it away from me and it slipped, gashing his hand badly. He started shouting. I was crying. The neighbours must have called the police. She barely remembered what happened next. She'd been hysterical, screaming in the road, the police officers restraining her, arms wrenched behind her back, a knee between her shoulder blades, her face crushed into the pavement. They took me somewhere, I don't remember what they called it, but it was a mental hospital.
Rapid assessment unit, Griffin says quietly.
Yes, that. She stops. She takes a deep breath in. She remembers arriving at the huge brick building, the shame and indignity of being strip and cavity searched by a woman, cold plastic gloves on her hands, unfeeling and rough as Jess sobbed in the glare of the overhead lights. Nobody listened. Nobody cared. The prick of the injections, then her head, fuzzy and slow. The night in the bare room on suicide watch, the lights on, unable to sleep, listening to the shouts and wails of the other patients echoing through the corridors. Patrick tried to have me sectioned, to keep me in there. The police agreed. If it wasn't for Nav speaking up for me, I don't know what would have happened. They fall back into silence. Griffin stopped what he was doing on the laptop, his fingers hovering on the keys. She waits, fearing his judgment. He clears his throat. That'll be it now, she thinks. He'll think I'm crazy for sure.
And you stayed with him,
Griffin says at last.
With Patrick. After that.
He loved me. He only wanted what was best for me.
Funny way of showing it,
Griffin mutters. But Jess doesn't mention how she felt at that time. That she wasn't fit to be a mother. That she knew if she left Patrick, there would be no way she'd get custody of Alice. The crushing knowledge that she was no better than a piece of shit on her husband's shoe. Something to clean off and discard. She remembers Patrick's threats that if she didn't get better, he'd call the police again, and this time she wouldn't be leaving, no matter what Nav said. He talked of electroconvulsive therapy, of lobotomies, drugs to dull her thoughts. She had no knowledge of what those things were, or even if they applied to her, but the fear. It was the fear that kept her in check. And that fear that now keeps her away from the police, knowing they have the power to put her there again.
I'm sorry, Jess,
Griffin says quietly, and she looks at him. He's staring down at the tabletop.
I get why you don't trust the police. I said I'd help you find who murdered Patrick, and I'm letting you down. I don't want to be another one of those people.
Jess looks at him. She shakes her head. That's not it at all, she says. She pauses. I needed to know what happened to Patrick, yes. But that feels a long time ago now. That's not why I've stayed. She reaches over and takes his hand. He looks at it for a moment, then lifts his head and meets her eyes. She's never seen him look so miserable. You're not letting me down, Griffin, she says. And you're not letting Mia down either. He looks down again quickly, pulling his hand away from hers. Jess curses inside her head. She shouldn't have said that about Mia. She gets up from the table and goes across to the kitchen. She's not hungry, but she wants to give him some space, or as much as she can in this tiny basement. But then she hears him push his chair out and feels him standing behind her. She turns, and he takes her face in his hands, kissing her gently. It's not like the other times they've kissed. It's slow, soft. He moves his hands into her hair, and she does the same, then down his back, under the hem of his shirt. They move towards the bed, taking clothes off as they go, smiling when a sock refuses to come off, when her t-shirt gets stuck on her head. They fall together, him on top of her, and she enjoys the feeling of the weight of him, the warmth of skin against skin. They're taking their time. Both of them are exploring, making the most of being with each other, in contrast to the frantic nature before. But it's not just the speed that's changed. They're actually looking at each other. At first, the eye contact seems strange, too intimate. But then Jess realizes she can't look away. She's lost, his light brown eyes on her, his long lashes, the smile lines at the corner of his eyes. She likes it, likes him. The lines on his face relax. He's watching her, smiling as her expression changes, depending on what he's doing, where he's putting his hands, his fingers, his mouth. This is different, she thinks. And then he's inside her, and she doesn't think much at all. They fall asleep, their bodies entwined. But when Jess wakes, Griffin has gone. She looks at the clock, confused. It's just past midnight. She sits up in bed, then sees his car keys lying on the table. He can't go far without the Land Rover. Something feels wrong. She gets up, puts a light on, and gets dressed. She looks around. Everything else is here. His rucksack, his laptop. But his coat has gone. His boots. Jess hesitates. But she can't bear sitting around doing nothing. She picks up the keys and climbs the stairs out of the flat. Outside, the air is cold but still. The same cars sit for sale on the lot. A taxi goes past on the road. She can't see Griffin. She takes a few steps out of the shadow of the main building, then something catches her eye. It's a shape on the ground. Clothing. What seems to be a body. A bad feeling grips her and she runs over, but relief when she sees it's not Griffin is replaced by horror. The woman's eyes are open, looking to the sky. Her mouth, lips raw, teeth damaged, is open in a silent scream. She's never seen a dead body like this before, not up close. The smell snags in her nose, decay, feces, an indescribable stench that makes her gag. Wet wounds cover the woman's body. She can see white bone poking through ripped skin. She takes a step back. Then breath catches in her throat as hands grip her arms tightly. She goes to scream but stops as she hears his voice.
Jess, what are you doing here? You have to go.
Griffin is behind her, guiding her back towards the flat. But she resists. The shock of seeing the woman is making her angry, hot tears running down her face. Where did you go, Griffin? She cries at him. Who is this? Where did you go? He left her to find this woman alone. He tries to quieten her, but she's still furious. Why is there a body here? Who is she?
I don't know, but I've called the police. You need to leave or they'll arrest you.
His face is frantic, pleading with her.
Please.
She nods. tearing her eyes away from the woman on the concrete. She can hear sirens in the distance and runs back to the basement. She closes the door behind her and gulps in deep breaths. The serial killer. The Echo Man. He was right outside the door. He was here. Chapter 56. By the time Kara arrives from the station, Deakin is already there and glaring at Griffin. Police cars surround the area, blue lights dancing on dark brickwork. Uniforms work to set up the cordon, a few passers-by show a quick interest. She was working late. She hadn't been home. She knows Rue is there and hasn't got the energy to face him. Not yet. "What have we got?" she asks. The two men stay silent. "Please? Someone?" Shenton steps forward out of the darkness. Kara hadn't even noticed him.
"Latest victim, female, showing clear signs of being beaten, possibly held against her will."
While Shenton is talking, Kara crouches down and looks at the body. She can see angry marks around the woman's wrists and ankles, raw wounds across her torso and head. Her dress is dirty and torn. She's not wearing any shoes. Or underwear, Kara realises. "Pathologist and crime scene are on their way."
"And do we know who this is?" Shenton shakes his head. "Or which serial killer it's copying?"
"Not until I know more," Shenton mutters. "Unfortunately, there are too many who have this as their MO.
Kara sighs. She's suddenly so tired. So fucking tired of this whole thing.
"And we think this is a body dump. Outside where you're living, Griffin," she adds.
"Kind of making a point, isn't he?" Griffin says. "Leaving the latest victim outside my front door."
"Unless it was you that put it there,"
Noah adds. Griffin scowls at him.
"Seriously? You think I'll kill someone, then leave them right outside my house? How dumb do you think I am?"
Deakin pulls a face, and before Kara can react, Griffin springs forward, all his weight behind his outstretched fist. She hears a wet crunch as he makes contact, Kara diving between them, shoving her brother away as Noah falls backwards onto the concrete. She looks at Griffin in shock.
"Nate! Back away!"
When Griffin doesn't move, she shouts again. "D.S. Griffin, back the fuck away!" Deakin's being pulled to his feet by Shenton, tentatively touching his face, wincing.
"Where were you tonight, Nate?"
he shouts. He puts his hand over his left eye, trying to stem the bleeding.
"Home? Alone? With no one to provide an alibi?"
Kara notices Griffin hesitate.
"How do we know? Seriously?"
Noah turns to Kara. Blood is starting to seep through his fingers, running down his wrist.
"Griffin has been here, oh so conveniently pointing stuff out every step of the way. And now this?"
"Shut up, both of you,"
Kara snaps.
"This poor woman deserves better than this. She deserves for us to find her killer and no,"
she says, as Deakin goes to interrupt.
"I don't think it's Griffin. Even he's not stupid enough to leave a dead body outside his own flat. Noah, go and get yourself cleaned up. Griffin, this garage must have CCTV.
He nods, quieter now.
"Track it down. I'll speak to you about this later."
Kara watches as Noah leaves and the group disperses. It was inevitable that the thin line of tolerance between Noah and Griffin would be crossed, and no sleep and no progress on the case meant it couldn't hold any longer. She remembers the conversation in the car. Griffin's temper frayed, and all it took was some baiting from Noah. She glances towards the side door that she knows leads to Griffin's basement. When Kara had originally got the call, she'd first thought that this was her, Jessica Ambrose, the murder suspect being concealed in Griffin's flat. But it's clear this victim is separate, and she briefly wonders where the other woman is. Barely 10 feet away, hiding, quiet. She knows Griffin is still looking into the arson, but she's done her own reading too, skimming the file, reviewing the evidence. And she agrees with him. It does fit. Another murder in the long line of serial killings. So arresting Jessica Ambrose has become less of a concern. And she has more pressing problems to deal with now. She looks at the dead woman lying on the concrete as she waits for SOCO to arrive. Her eyes are open and glassy, staring accusingly upwards. Kara knows the body being placed here wasn't coincidence. He's closer. He knows who they are, where they live. The killer is taunting them. Day 8. Monday. Chapter 57. The day is cold and bright. Sun shines through gaps in the trees, lighting up the corner of the graveyard. The area is secluded from the road, with one walkway in and out. Flowers are arranged at the front, around a large photograph of Libby. It's a nice one, provided by her parents. They understood and agreed to the plan, once Kara had explained it to them. They want this guy caught. Kara is good at the people stuff, the bits Griffin has never managed. He watches his sister now, standing at the front of the group. Her voice is steady and clear in the still air. She's talking about Libby. A eulogy worked on until the early hours, calling on input from her family and friends. Griffin knows that Kara would have wanted to get it right. As much as this is a ploy, it is still honouring Libby. Griffin had liked her. Kara said that she would have approved of this plan. His eyes feel scratchy. He didn't get any sleep last night, as he knows nobody did. He had tracked down the CCTV, scrolling through the footage from outside the garage, but the body had been placed in a blind spot. They couldn't see who had dumped it. He only knew that when he'd left Jess, it hadn't been there. And when he'd got back, it had. And Jess had looked at him, questions in her eyes. He wants to see her. He needs to explain where he went, but the shame burns too strongly. She thinks he's someone he's not. She thinks he's strong, good, someone worthy of loving. It's a nice feeling. He doesn't want to destroy that just yet. SOCO ran the scene all night, and as the sun came up, the remains were taken away, and he came straight here. He's standing at the back of the group, and his gaze shifts around the crowd. One of the other DCs is taking photographs, ensuring they capture all attendees on film. Next to him, Shenton seems anxious.
"Stop fidgeting,"
he hisses, and Shenton stops moving, grasping one of his hands tightly in the other. There's a lot riding on this plan, Griffin thinks. He's right to be nervous. A new corpse. Nothing back from the cryptographer about the message. No fingerprints on the note. No DNA on the envelope. And they got the lab reports back from the Dharma flat this morning. The only evidence belonged to Michael Sharp. As time passes, the more Griffin's afraid. For Jess. For his sister. Could the Echo Man be here? Could Shenton be right? There's Libby's parents and her brother. The detectives from the investigation are scattered throughout the group. There are people Griffin doesn't recognise, their faces downcast, some of them crying. Griffin knows they must be Libby's friends, her colleagues. Something inside him assumes he'd recognise a killer, that he'd see someone and a switch would be flipped, a sudden flicker of eye contact and he'd know it was the man from that terrible night. But he feels nothing when he looks at these people. He feels the familiar flash of failure in himself. The self-loathing that even he, a detective, can't find the man that murdered his own wife. What point are all these years of experience if he can't recognise the one man that matters the most? His eyes continue to take in the crowd. Deakin is on the far side with Rue. He remembers Rue knew Libby too. He wonders how much Kara has told her husband, and whether he believes this memorial is real. He wonders if Kara has spoken to him about the affair. Deakin mutters a comment to Rue and he nods in reply. Noah's face is slightly swollen on the left side where Griffin hit him. Black and green bruises starting to show in the red. Butterfly stitches across his eyebrow. Deakin looks miserable. But then Griffin thinks. He doesn't think he's ever seen his sister's partner crack a smile when she's not around. He bloody hates that guy. He sees Deacon watching Kara as she introduces someone else to speak at the front. Not for the first time does he wonder whether Noah Deacon holds a candle for his sister, hoping one day their professional partnership will turn personal. Kara has better taste than that, though, he thinks. And up until this week, he would have believed that Rue, dressed today in a smart suit and tie, was a much better match for her. But even the good guys can let you down, he notes cynically. The memorial is coming to an end, Kara thanking Libby's father for his speech. Griffin looks across to the detective with the camera and tilts his head to one side. Did you get it all? He's asking. The DC gives a small nod. A new arrival on the edge of the group catches Griffin's eye. He's wearing a smart black coat, the collar pulled up, and he's staring at Griffin. The man raises a hand slightly, and Griffin recognizes him. It's Nav. He walks over. Nav pulls a piece of paper out of his pocket and holds it out.
What's this? Griffin asks.
Jess called me. She said you'd be here. She said you needed this. Griffin takes the piece of paper and looks at it.
This is a prescription for cocodamol.
It's the best I can do.
I'm on oxy, Nav. This will barely touch the sides.
So go to your own doctor, Griffin. Nav puts his hands back in his pockets and goes to walk away. Griffin reaches out and grabs his arm. Nav pulls away from him, angrily.
Listen, Nav growls. I'm only here for Jess. I don't know you.
Griffin catches the look on Nav's face.
So that's it, he says, slowly. It's not that you don't like me. It's that you're jealous.
Nav glares at him.
You waited years, and now the husband's finally out of the way. You're pissed you missed your chance.
Nav takes a step forward towards him.
I was Patrick's friend too, he hisses. Were you though?
Griffin mocks.
Really? Or were you just biding your time until Jess saw the error of her ways?
Nav glares at him.
You're not good enough for her. She knows that. Maybe that's true, Dr. Boy, but I'm the one she's fucking.
Griffin puts the last crass word in deliberately. He's desperate for a fight. He wants Nav to punch him, to inflict a bit of deserved pain. He sees the anger cross Nav's face. He knows he's got to him, and Griffin tenses. But Nav turns on his heel and strides away without comment.
Who was that? Kara's standing next to him.
Don't worry, he's not important, Griffin mutters. You were good today, he says, forcing his voice to sound positive.
Yes, well, we'll see. Let's hope our man showed. She turns and starts to walk back to the car. He follows her. As he walks, he looks at the prescription in his hand, then crumples it into a ball. He can feel his hand start to shake, the agitation in his body. He knows he only has 2 doses left. He knows soon he'll be in pain, his back in crippling agony. And he has no idea what he's going to do about it.
Chapter 58. They're right. He's there, watching. And he blends in among the smart suits, the black, the downcast faces. He forces his expression to remain unhappy, corners of his mouth turned down, head towards the grass. At one point, he even manages a tear. He's proud of that. He's learned to copy emotions, to mimic the feelings of others, a necessary evil to keep plodding through the tedium of his life. The man at the front of the group starts crying, shoulders shaking. Libby's father, he remembers from the introduction. How much more upset would he be, he wonders, if he knew how his daughter died, if he knew the look of fear that passed across Libby's face when he showed her the gun. The few seconds he allowed her to run before he started shooting, the stirring in his groin as the bullet tore through her flesh as she fell to the ground, her hands reaching out in the mud in those last desperate moments. How he sat in the car after, closed his eyes, and masturbated, remembering her death. He was 9 when he first realized what got him going. He'd seen the erect penises of his father and uncle. He'd seen the ecstatic looks on their faces, experienced firsthand with his small, fragile body, how they got their rocks off, and he'd wondered, how can I be normal if I don't enjoy this? He'd sneaked in and looked at their porn stash, risking a beating to flick through the pages of naked women, naked men, fucking, penetrating, bodies writhing in pleasure, and he'd felt nothing. But then, he knew. He'd stolen a knife from the kitchen, weighed it up in his hand and crept upstairs. He'd waited in the hallway and peered through the open doors, bedrooms side by side. They'd been sleeping, the heavy, drunken slumber of men who had satisfied themselves at his expense, and he'd gone into his uncle's room. He'd stood at the end of the bed, knife in hand, and for the first time he'd felt himself grow hard. He'd touched his penis through his powder-blue dinosaur pajamas. So, this was what it was like. He'd killed his uncle first, thrusting the knife into his chest over and over, blood spattering up the walls, covering him from top to toe. The man barely had a chance to wake up. He'd gone into his father's room next, and done the same. Then he'd reached down and picked up his father's flaccid penis between two fingers. With three strokes of the knife, he'd sawed through, exerting little more effort than he'd need to cut through gristle connecting raw sausages. He'd discarded it on the floor, and as his father opened his eyes, gurgling incomprehensible noises as his chest collapsed, he knew. He'd felt the sticky, warm blood coating his chest, the metallic iron tang in his mouth, and he'd held his own penis in his hand. It didn't take long. The murders had been more than he'd needed, and with a few quick strokes he was ejaculating, cum across the bed, across his father's dead, mutilated body. That had been the beginning. But this memorial, this sham, this is not the end. That will come soon. A date that's been forever lodged in his mind, that will shortly be marked by something else, something impressive, magnificent, something that will haunt them all for the rest of their lives. If they survive.
Chapter 59. Everything is a puzzle. They are studying the photographs from the memorial, painstakingly trying to identify every face in the crowd. Shenton is working on the cipher again. Any luck? Kara asks him, and he frowns.
I hate to say this, he mutters, but I'm starting to think it's not possible to crack. After all, some of the original ciphers from the Zodiac Killer were never decoded.
Kara stares at him. 1,000 swear words filter through her mind, but she somehow doesn't say any of them.
Did you hear back about the handwriting? Shenton asks in the face of her silence.
She nods. The expert thinks left-handed, and distinctive enough to compare if we get any suspects.
You know the Zodiac Killer was thought to be ambidextrous, Shenton says, offhand. So any handwriting analysis might not work.
Kara grits her teeth. He's just trying to be helpful, she tells herself. Don't take this nightmare situation out on him. She moves away from Shenton before she says something she'll regret and goes over to the whiteboard. She stares at the rows of victims, the woman found outside Griffin's flat added to the grim lineup. Dr. Ross has given his view. Cause of death? Electrocution. That and contributory factors from starvation, dehydration, sexual assault, torture, and blunt force trauma. He guesses she was held against her will for about a week. Gary Heidnik, Shenton had muttered, allocating a serial killer to the murder. She picks up the lab report received that morning. Libby had a blood alcohol level in line with the few drinks they knew she had consumed in the bar. Michael Sharp had a long list of drugs in his bloodstream, but again, nothing strange knowing the sort of pharmaceuticals he liked to imbibe. There were no prints on the gun. No DNA. The only cells under Libby's fingernails were her own. no foreign saliva. The material sent to the newspaper with the cipher was confirmed to have traces of Libby's blood, and a matching hole was found in her dress, but nothing else. It's been the same all along. Come on, she mutters under her breath. Make a mistake. But she knows that might mean another murder. And how could she wish for something so evil? Even if they could catch the guy. She looks at the names of the victims across the top of the board. Lisa Kershaw, Daria Capshaw, Sarah Jackman, Marissa Perez, Anne Lees, Elizabeth Roberts, Michael Sharp. Multiple people they haven't yet been able to identify, and Mia Griffin. Kara resolves that once this is over, once the Echo Man is caught and behind bars, she will make sure these are the names that are remembered. These were all someone's daughter, father, brother, wife. These are the people that matter. She taps a finger on Libby's photo, then one on Mia's. I'll find this guy, she mutters to herself. For you. Then Kara wonders about Libby's phone and laptop. She takes a long breath in and out. I need a change of scene, she thinks, and leaves, walking down the 5 flights of stairs to the basement. The digital lab requested their offices were sited down here. It was the place no one else wanted, with the lack of natural light, the distance from the canteen. But that must be what they like about it, Kara thinks, the automatic lights flicking on as she walks down the corridor. The room seems in darkness as she comes to the door at the end. She tries the handle, but it's locked. There's a doorbell to the right, and she presses it. After a moment, a hiss announces someone listening. DCI Elliot, she says to the intercom. A buzz indicates she's allowed inside, and she pushes the door open. The room is dimly lit. On one side, shelves of equipment dominate, wires falling haphazardly out of their boxes, some littering the floor. There are rows of computers, a gentle glow coming from one in front of her. Hello? She calls. A face pops out from behind the monitor. The man smiles. How can I help? His appearance and friendly manner disarms her. He's good-looking, with a trendy haircut and nice eyes behind his glasses. DCI Kara Elliot, she repeats. I was wondering how you were getting on with the laptop and phone. So you came down here? He says. You don't get many visitors? None. He reaches across and pulls a chair over to his computer. Come and join me. I'll look. Charlie Mills, he says, holding out his hand. You're Charlie Mills, she replies, shaking it. She can hardly reconcile this guy with the name she's seen signing off any number of completely incomprehensible reports that have passed her desk over the years. She expected someone monosyllabic, maybe balding, slightly overweight. He laughs. Don't worry, I'm used to it. Come back when it's not curry day in the canteen and meet my team. They'll conform to your expectations. What's the case number? Kara reels it off and he types it into the computer. He pulls up a report, then glances across at her. Says here we sent you this yesterday. Oh, Kara feels stupid. Who did you send it to? He says the name of the mailbox and Kara frowns. It's the joint one, used for unimportant information, rather than urgent reports of this kind. Okay, well, she mutters. It's a bit of a worry. Can you tell me what it said, while I'm here?
Would love to,
Charlie replies with a grin. Kara wonders if he's flirting with her, then dismisses it. He must be, what, early 30s? She's sure he's got better people to smile at than a married mother of 2. Charlie scrolls down the page, his eyes flicking over the text. Says here the laptop didn't come up with anything useful. Didn't do much on it except social media, personal photographs and emails. Anything in the emails?
You can take it away and check for yourself if you like, but nothing my guy seemed to think was suspicious.
Oh, but this is more important. Kara stares at him as he recites a long list of names that sound like gobbledygook. He laughs at her blank look.
Illegally uploaded spyware and viruses, he clarifies. It means that if she was using her computer, someone could see what she was doing and monitor her keystrokes.
So they would know her passwords?
Exactly.
Charlie's face is suddenly serious.
Luckily, she never brought her work home, but everything else, well, this guy knew.
Any way of working out who?
He shakes his head.
Afraid not. Looks like my techie did a bit of digging, but they were all dead ends. Plus, here,
he points at the screen.
He was able to watch her through the webcam.
Kara shudders. The thought of the guy watching Libby's every move. It's terrifying. No wonder he knew how to tailor the Tinder profile to appeal to her.
What about her mobile?
Kara asks.
She watches as he reads the next report.
Nothing of note, I'm afraid. Although we did do a bit of work on that dating profile she was connected with.
He reads on.
There's even a set of geographic coordinates for one of the messages he sent.
You have a location? Kara's excited. This could be the lead they need.
Wait a sec, they forgot to run it back.
Charlie types for a bit, then frowns.
Well, that can't be right,
he mutters, typing again.
What?
Charlie turns to her, a shocked expression on his face.
The location, he starts. It comes back to here.
What do you mean?
It comes back to the Nick. This message was sent from within the walls of this police station.
Chapter 60. Kara walks back to the incident room, her head spinning. The room is busy, detectives working behind their desks, some chatting, others silent. There's Deakin, head down, reviewing reports, Griffin with one of the DCs. She looks at them all and she wonders, is it you? She sits down at her computer and clicks on the group mailbox. There are a few messages in there and she scrolls down looking for the email from the digital team. She can't see it, so she runs a search through all the folders. Still nothing. Has someone deleted it? Wanting to hide the evidence of what they'd done? Has the killer realised he'd made a mistake? Deakin comes over and she quickly clicks away.
Listen, we had a thought about the letter, he says, and she looks up at him.
Are you okay? He adds. You look pale.
I'm fine, she mutters, but she needs to tell someone. Sit down, she whispers, and he does, his face puzzled. I've just been with the digital lab. They said there was spyware on Libby's computer.
Someone was watching her, Deakin says, and she nods.
But that's not all. They said that one of the messages on the man's profile on Tinder was sent from here.
Here?
Deakin looks up, glancing around.
You mean from the incident room?
Not necessarily, from the police station.
What? So our guy's a cop?
Kara sees Deakin's expression. It's astonishment. Disbelief. The same feelings she knows she has on her own face.
Could be, like Toby said. Or a civilian, someone from control or admin. Or any number of people working out of this building.
But they couldn't narrow it down any more than that.
No, they just needed to be here when they sent that message. And this stays between us, right?
Deakin nods quickly. She sighs.
What were you going to ask me?
So we want to get someone to have a closer look at the paper the note is written on. There are no fingerprints, but I read that specialised machines can detect if there are tiny indentations we can't see with the naked eye. If this page came from a notebook, we might be able to make out things he had written down before.
Kara nods.
ESDA, electrostatic detection, yes. They can find secondary impressions on the paper,
she adds, annoyed she hadn't thought of it herself.
But it's expensive. We need you to ask Marsh for the budget.
No problem, okay,
Kara replies. He'll have to say yes after yesterday's conversation, surely.
How's the face?
Deakin's hand goes up to the bruise. She reaches over and he allows her to gently push the corner of one of the bits of tape back down with the tip of her finger. He cringes slightly.
Does it hurt?
Not really. Just worried it's going to damage my rugged good looks,
he adds with a lopsided smile.
Will you put in a formal complaint?
Noah sighs.
I can't be asked, Kara. I probably deserved it. And besides, he seems to be looking worse than me.
Kara looks across the office to where Griffin is sitting. He's straight in his seat. His face is tense.
They all look shit right now, but Noah's right. He's not well.
He seems ill,
Deacon adds.
I think he needs to go home.
Thanks, I'll talk to him. Deacon stands up, but she grabs his hand before he goes. He turns. Really, Noah? Thank you. He smiles and leaves, and she follows him out into the office, going across to Griffin. Up close, he seems even worse. There's a fine sheen of sweat on his forehead. His face is almost yellow. Nate, are you okay? She asks, and he looks up suddenly. He hesitates.
I'm fine.
You're not fine. You're ill. Go home if you need to. He runs his hand across his forehead. She notices he's shivering.
Yes, I think I will,
he says quietly. Do you want me to drive you? He shakes his head quickly.
No, no. They need you here.
She watches as he stands, picks up his bag and leaves. He's walking slowly, as if putting one foot in front of the other needs all his concentration. She thinks about following him, forcing someone to take him, but she knows he'll hate the intrusion. Just the fact he's agreed to leave of his own accord is enough. She stands outside her office, at the edge of the incident room, watching the team all hard at work. The detectives behind the rows of computers, still examining CCTV. The analysts scrolling through data. The inquiry officers following up on every tip from the public, however unlikely, however crazy. Kara thinks about what the digital lab found. About the Tinder account. She watches them all. And again she thinks, is it you? Is it you?
Chapter 61. Now this is a nice house. He looks up at the row of windows, the bright red front door, then walks the last few feet up the gravel driveway. Her car is here, and he knows she's alone. He's been watching her, and she's just right. This is it. He's ready. He takes a deep breath in and rings the bell. The door opens. The first blow with his fist sends her backwards, blood spouting from her nose. The second, on the mouth, knocks her to the floor, arms windmilling. He hears her jaw crack. He sees her eyes widen in pain. He walks into the hallway after her, and she pushes frantically away, her hands struggling to get purchase, her shoes squeaking on the tiled surface. He leans down and hits her again, knuckles breaking her eye socket, a second on the side of her head. She looks dazed. He hears her try to say something through her mangled lips, blood and dribble running down her chin. He stands over her, savoring the moment. He knows what he's going to do. He grabs her by the top of her arm, pulling her up and ripping her shirt open. Buttons ping off and bounce on the floor. Stitches rip as he wrenches it clear of her body. Her bra is pink and lacy and delicate. He grabs it by the front and uses it to drag her further into the house, offering him little resistance as he tears it off forcefully, searing her skin. The woman's still struggling. She has fight in her. He likes that. He places a few well-aimed kicks in her stomach, feels a crack as ribs break, and she doubles over, then vomits violently. He rolls her over onto her front, face down, then reaches into his pocket and takes out a length of cord. He wraps it around her neck, crossing it over, then pulling his knee on the middle of her back. She gurgles. He sees her eyes roll back in her head, but he lets go. Not too hard, he thinks. Not yet. Skirt next, then tights, matching knickers. Nice. This bitch knows how to take care of herself. They tear into shreds as he drags them down her legs. He smells sweat and urine. Shoes have gone already in the struggle, lying on their side in a puddle of blood. He can feel his heart beating faster. He's hard with anticipation. He stands over her prostrate naked body, fingering himself lightly through his jeans. He looks at her bare skin, bruises starting to show, at her juicy cunt, the tight ass he knows is waiting for him. She's just looking over her shoulder, the last vestiges of consciousness still flickering. He looks back at the open front door, to the empty street beyond. He pushes the door with his foot, and as he does so, he sees the hope ebb away from her eyes. It closes with a click. He doesn't want to be disturbed. He wants to make this one last, remember every detail, because this is it. The beginning of the end.
Chapter 62. Griffin almost falls as he staggers through the door and Jess guides him to the bed. He lies down with a thud. She can see the pain clear on his face. This is ridiculous, Griffin. Take something.
I've only got one left.
She goes to his bag and pulls out the packet. Sure enough, there's one lonely capsule. She pushes it out of the foil and gives it to him with a glass of water. Take it, she demands. He levers himself up slowly on one elbow and swallows the drug, then slumps back down on the bed. Did you see Nav? He frowns.
He gave me a prescription for cocodamol. It's useless.
This is ridiculous, Jess exclaims. I'm calling him again.
He won't help me, Griffin says.
Something in his voice makes Jess turn, his mobile in her hand. What did you say to him? Griffin's face clouds. What did you say?
We had an exchange of views. It doesn't matter.
Look at you, it does matter. She turns away from him and dials Nav's number. After a few rings, he answers, his voice sharp. What? Nav, you need to help Griffin, Jess says. He doesn't want my help. Oxy, Nav, not whatever shit you offered him. Oxycodone is a controlled drug, Jess. He's not my patient. Tell him to go to his doctor. Go to A&E, anything. He says you had an argument. There's silence at the end of the phone. What did he say, Nav? Another pause. It's not important. It's not because of that. Nav sounds upset, flustered. But Jess hasn't got time for that now. She moves away from the bed so Griffin can't hear her. Look, she says. I know he's an asshole. I know he can be difficult, but he's been through a lot. Please, Nav. For me? There's silence again. Then Jess hears Nav grunt. Fine. I'll come over when I've finished here. And Jess? Yes? Alice gets out of hospital in a few hours. The wave of emotion catches Jess by surprise. She's better, she manages to croak. Well enough. She's going to stay with your parents. She was asking about you and Patrick. Jess can't bring herself to talk. You need to end this, Jess, Nav continues. For Alice's sake, you need to hand yourself in to the police. Then they'll let you see her. Alice needs her mum.
Just bring the prescription for Griffin. Thank you, Jess mutters, then hangs up.
She waits for a moment, a lump in her throat, forcing it back down. Then she goes and joins Griffin on the bed, lying next to him. His eyes are closed. Nav's bringing a prescription over later.
For Oxy?
Yes.
Thank you,
he says quietly. He opens his eyes slightly and looks at her.
I'm not an asshole.
Jess smiles. Then stop acting like one, Griffin. He nods, then winces. She reaches over and takes his hand, winding her fingers around his. They lie like that for a while. Jess listens to his breathing. She hears the cars on the road. Conversation coming from the garage forecourt outside. Alice is coming out of hospital today, she says quietly. Griffin doesn't reply. She wonders if he's asleep. I want to go and see her.
You should,
he mumbles. What if there are police there? I should stay with you.
I'll be fine. You know what to look out for. Take the Land Rover, borrow one of my credit cards in case you need money, and if you see anyone odd, just drive away.
He opens his eyes, his focus hazy, then indicates towards the bedside table.
Bottom drawer.
He doesn't elaborate, and she leans down to open it. Then she stops. Inside is a grey cotton jumper, an embroidered logo of a rainbow on the front. It's soft and smells clean and well looked after.
You need something else to wear,
Griffin mutters. Jess looks down at her top. The same jumper Nav had bought her all those days ago. She's been washing it when she can, but Griffin's right. It's stained and dirty from nearly a week's constant use.
I can't take this, she begins, but he interrupts her.
Please. She'd have wanted you to have it.
I don't know how I'll ever be able to repay you for all of this, Nate.
Jess holds the jumper tenderly, looking at him. He's closed his eyes again, lying back on the pillow.
For keeping me safe. For looking after me.
He opens one eye briefly.
Just write me an IOU, he says quietly. Services rendered for a damsel in distress.
She reaches over and takes his hand again, squeezing it softly. He returns the gesture. Then she sits up on the bed, getting changed quickly and putting her shoes on. The jumper is slightly too big, but it's warm and clean, and she takes comfort from it being a part of him. She leans over, kissing him softly on the lips.
I'll be as quick as I can. Thank you, Nate.
She's almost out of the door when she hears his voice again.
Jess.
Hmm?
She turns. He's pulled himself up slightly, looking at her.
You called me Nate.
Do you mind? He lies back down on the bed.
No.
She smiles and picks up the keys to the Land Rover. The truck starts without a hitch and Jess takes it as a good sign. She drives across town and parks a few rows down from her parents' house. She knows which way they'll come from if they're driving from the hospital, but she has no idea when. Nav had said a few hours, so she settles herself down in the seat for a wait. She scans the other cars parked in the road, but there's nobody nearby. After all this time, there's no way she's handing herself into the police. Griffin's working on the investigation. They'll find something. They'll find this killer, and then they'll know she had nothing to do with Patrick's death. The fire seems a distant memory. Her recollection of Patrick is hazy, like a surreal dream. It's still too much for her to come to terms with, that her husband is dead. Her life with Griffin feels not normal, but Jess isn't sure. She thinks about Griffin, lying in pain back at the flat. She can't comprehend what that's like, to suffer in that way. And for the first time, she considers her condition as a blessing rather than a curse. Griffin seems like such an immovable force. To see him taken down so completely is sobering. Sitting in the old Land Rover reminds her of him. It smells of cigarettes. There is mess strewn around. For the first time, she wonders about his wife, the woman who used to wear this jumper, and what he was like as a husband. The day is drawing to a close, and the street lights blink into life. A few cars come down the road but don't stop. Then, at last, she sees her mum's Nissan Note come towards her and turn into the drive. She watches as the car parks up and the headlights turn off. Her mother gets out of the car and opens the door at the back. Then, there she is. Alice is chattering away happily. Her hair is loose and cascades around her face. Jess instantly relaxes. Her daughter is here. She's fine. She puts her hand on the door to open it. Then something makes her pause. Out of the corner of her eye, she sees a white hatchback drive slowly down the road. It stops a few cars down from Jess and turns its headlights off. But nobody gets out. She can see a woman sitting in the front. Every muscle in Jess's body wants to get out of the car. She wants to go to her daughter, to hold her in her arms. But instinctively she knows that this car is police. She knows she can't move. She starts to cry as she turns the ignition key to the Land Rover. She takes one last look at her daughter. The front door to her parents' house is open and her mother is ushering Alice inside. She's safe. She's happy. She's well. That's all that matters, Jess tells herself as she pulls out of the parking space. She drives away from the house, looking in her rearview mirror as she goes. The white hatchback isn't following her. She's alone. She wants to get back to Griffin. The absence of her daughter is a heavy weight, but with a weird jolt,
she realizes how much she needs to be back with him. That being next to Griffin will ease that sadness slightly, and she drives quickly through the dark streets. She sees the garage ahead and pulls the Land Rover back into its parking space, then climbs out. The garage is closed now, the lights in the office turned off. She looks towards the one basement window. It's strange, it's dark there too. She wonders if Nav has been. Perhaps Griffin is asleep, lulled into slumber with the arrival of new pharmaceuticals. She pushes open the unwieldy metal door and goes down the stairs. She puts the key in the lock and opens the door. It's dark, and she stops, letting her eyes adjust. She looks towards the bed. It's empty. Griffin's not there. She frowns, worried. He can't have gone out. She has his keys, his car. She takes a step forward, but her foot catches on something on the floor. She looks down. There's a lump in front of her. Something in the dark. She takes a quick breath in and grasps around for the light. The sudden brightness dazzles, but she knows. She falls to her knees next to him, shouting his name. Griffin's lying on his side, his head at an angle. It looks as if he was trying to get to the door. She shakes his body, trying to wake him, but he doesn't move. She panics. Her brain races to remember even the slightest bit of basic first aid. She shakes him again, then rolls him onto his back. She leans next to his mouth. His breathing is laboured, his heart rate slow, but he's alive. She picks up the phone on the table and dials 999. "Ambulance!" she gasps. She's put through. A voice asks her name, where she is. She gives the address, but then stops. Her name. She tells them who she is, and she'll be arrested. She's called the ambulance. She should leave. Run, now. But she can't leave Griffin. She can't. "Jessica Ambrose," she says. "Please come quickly." The operator asks her about the patient. "Nate Griffin. He's unconscious, barely breathing." Jess crouches next to him. Then she notices it. Written in the dust next to his hand are what look like letters. She squints. They're shaky, but she can make out a few. S-H-I. She turns her head, trying to read them the right way around. P-M. She takes a sudden breath. She knows. She knows what Griffin was trying to tell her. "Diamorphine!" Jess shouts down the phone. "He's had an overdose of diamorphine!" "Stay on the line," the operator says. "The ambulance is on its way." Jess slumps back on the floor, sitting next to Griffin. The phone clutched in one shaking hand, his hand gripped in the other. "Shipman," she whispers to herself. "Harold Shipman." Part 3. Chapter 63. The paramedics arrive, pushing through the open door, and Jess moves backwards out of their way. They're a mass of movement around Griffin, relaying messages to each other, putting a mask over his face, pushing air into his lungs. Jess is stunned to see Griffin like this. Unconscious. Close to death. A uniformed cop appears by her side. She's ready for the arrest, but he's oblivious, asking her questions about what happened. "My friend Nav was supposed to come over," she gabbles. "I don't know if he did." "Full name?" the policeman asks, notepad poised in his hand. "Dr. Navin Sharma. He works in oncology at the General. He might still be on shift." He makes a note, then looks up as a woman comes into the room. Her face is stern, eyes locked on Jess. She recognises her. It's the detective from the hospital. The woman moves forwards, blocking her exit. "Jessica Ambrose," the detective gets straight to the point. "I am arresting you on suspicion of the murder of Patrick Ambrose on Monday the 25th of January. The uniformed cop backs off, confused. The detective jerks Jess's hands away from her sides, fastening cuffs in front of her. "You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence." She pulls her away, out of the door, and up the metal stairs, away from Griffin. But Jess resists. "Please," she pleads. "Just let me know that Nate's okay." One of the paramedics goes to push past them on the stairs, and the detective gets his attention.
How is he?
She asks. He pauses.
We've given him an intramuscular dose of naloxone. He's responded well, so we haven't needed to intubate, he says. We'll take him in shortly. They'll probably follow up with an IV at the hospital.
So he's going to be all right? Jess asks in a rush. The paramedic nods.
Looks that way.
He looks to the detective.
He doesn't have the hallmarks of your usual intravenous drug user, although we found a needle mark on his forearm.
He's not, Jess blurts out. He didn't do this to himself. The floor, she tries, desperate to make them listen. He knew. The paramedic gives her an apathetic look and carries on his way to get something out of the ambulance. The detective pulls on Jess's hands and they follow on up the stairs and out into the car lot, where a police car awaits. As they go, Jess remembers back to where Griffin had been lying. The letters on the floor had been obliterated, scuffed out by the paramedic's shoes. Chapter 64. When Noah appears in the doorway of her office, she knows from the look on his face that it's bad. But Nate? She almost can't believe that her strong, no-nonsense brother has been attacked again.
The hospital says he's going to be fine, he adds quickly. But I'll get your car. We'll go and see him now.
Kara grabs her coat and they rush out of the station. But before they get on the road, Kara stops him. She puts a hand on his arm, and Deacon looks at her.
Noah, Kara says.
She's forcing herself to speak slowly, her whole body in panic mode.
I need you to do me a favour, something I only trust you to do.
He sees her expression and looks worried.
Anything.
You're having a laugh. We can't just up and leave. Kara stands in front of her husband at the restaurant, Deacon hovering in the background.
Rue, listen to me. Someone tried to kill Griffin. I can't have you or the kids put at risk.
Rue gestures around the kitchen.
I have a lunch service to run. I have...
Sod the lunch service, Kara shouts. I am not asking you, I am telling you. You need to take your car and go with Noah. Pick the kids up from school and head to the lodge. You'll be safe there.
For how long? He asks, stunned. Until this is over. Until...
His voice trails off.
This is absurd, he mutters.
But Kara knows he'll do as she asks.
I'll call Lauren. I'll get her to pack the kids' things.
Kara shakes her head. No. Not with Lauren, she adds quietly. Rue stares at her.
I know, Rue, Kara says.
She's aware her voice is wobbling. She can't fall apart now.
I know what you've been doing. Together.
He stops. She notices his cheeks colour slightly.
I haven't...
He starts, but she can tell by the tone of his voice that she's right.
But we can't leave her here. He manages to stutter. If we're in danger, then so is she.
She's not going with you. Kara turns away.
But Kara...
Rue starts.
Do not fuck with me!
Kara's shaking. She's so angry.
My brother is in the hospital. There's an insane serial killer on the loose, and you want to take your mistress to our holiday lodge after having an affair under my nose for the past God knows how long!
She's shouting, knowing she's getting looks from the other chefs in the kitchen, but not caring.
Rue, get your stuff and go with Noah, now!
She walks out of the back door of the kitchen and stands next to her husband's car. She's crying now. Big, snotty tears, and she angrily wipes them away with her sleeve. Deacon appears by her side. She glances at him and he hands her a tissue.
I'm sorry, Noah, this isn't fair on you. It's fine, really. I'll take him to the lodge and get back as soon as I can. Listen, Kara.
Noah looks uncomfortable, his hands shoved in his pockets.
Yes?
He goes to say something, but then notices Rue coming towards them.
It doesn't matter,
Noah mumbles. The two of them get into the car and her husband winds down the window.
Call me when you have the kids, she says,
and Rue nods. Once the car turns the corner out of sight, Kara instantly feels better. Her family will be safe. That's all that matters for now. She'll deal with the shit between Rue and Lauren later, A waiter rushes out of the kitchen, a mobile clutched in his hand. "Chef!" he calls down the deserted road, but it's too late. "He's forgotten his phone," he says. "I'll take it," Kara replies, and he passes it across. She'll give it back to him later. There's no reception at the lodge, anyway. But as she gets back into her own car, throwing her husband's phone on the passenger seat, she remembers Deacon and wonders what he was about to say. She shakes her head. It can't have been that important. It can wait, she tells herself. It'll have to wait. She needs to go to the hospital, see her brother, make sure he's okay. Then she has a serial killer to catch. Chapter 65. The detective says nothing during the ride in the police car. They arrive at the station and Jess is escorted to custody. She takes the handcuffs off. Jess nods at the right points, signs the pieces of paper when she's told to. She shakes her head when she's asked if she wants a solicitor. She's shown into a cell. She sits down on the blue plastic-covered mattress. The door is closed with a metallic bang. There's muffled shouting from the cell next door. She's aware of people coming and going in the corridor, but she doesn't move. Now that she's here, now she's been arrested for her husband's murder, she feels numb. She doesn't feel the fear she expected. Suddenly she's been swept along in a sea of inevitability, all decisions made for her. She thinks about Griffin, in the ambulance on the way to hospital. She thinks about Alice. She lies back on the crinkly plastic bed. She puts the blanket behind her head and closes her eyes, hoping that at least now she can see her daughter. Jess is woken by the sound of the door opening. A man calls her name and beckons for her to follow him.
"It's time," he says,
escorting her down a corridor and into an interview room. The detective is waiting. She points to the chair opposite. Jess sits down. The woman detective introduces herself, then reads the caution again. D.S. Taylor, Jess remembers now. "And you're turning down your right to free independent legal advice," Taylor says. "Yes," Jess replies. She knows it's not sensible to refuse a lawyer, but her self-destructive urge has kicked back in. "Charge me with his murder," she thinks. "Just do something to punish me for what happens to the people I love. They end up injured or dead. First Patrick and Alice, now Griffin." "Can I see my daughter?" she asks.
"All in good time," Taylor looks at her notes. "You tell me what I need to know and maybe we can sort something out. Now, please talk me through the events of the night of Monday the 25th of January when your house caught fire."
Jess opens her mouth to talk, but a knock disturbs them. "Interview paused 17:46. Taylor sighs and gets up to open the door. There's a woman on the other side. She's tall, dark hair, dressed in a smart shirt and black jeans. Jess knows exactly who this is. Griffin's sister, Kara Elliott. It feels strange, her being so close. Like seeing a celebrity in the flesh. Elliot says something to Taylor, and Jess hears her swear.
"What do you mean you need her?" Jess hears Taylor say.
Elliot says something else. Taylor looks furious, but mutters,
"Yes, Gov."
Kara stares at Jess, then tilts her head towards the exit. "Come with me, please." Taylor watches, glum-faced, as Jess leaves. Jess walks wordlessly down the corridor into a different interview room. The DCI closes the door behind them but makes no attempt to sit down. "Jessica, I'm Detective Chief Inspector Elliot," she says. "How is Griffin?" Jess asks. "Please." DCI Elliot smiles. "He's doing fine, awake and talking in hospital. Thank you for calling the ambulance," she says. "You saved his life."
"He saved mine," Jess replies. "Can I see him?"
"No, I'm sorry." The detective's face turns serious again. "I need you to help us. We have Dr. Sharma in custody."
"Nav? Why?" Jess stutters.
"We've arrested him for attempted murder."
"What?"
Jess can't believe what she's hearing.
Why would Nav want to kill Griffin? You must have the wrong person. He's a doctor. He saves lives.
Elliot frowns.
We turned up at the hospital to interview him and he confessed straight away. Says he's prepared to make a full statement.
To what?
What does he say he